We're going to start out with Robert. Robert is the Power Marketing Manager for Western Area Power Administration. And then we'll go to Ray Wall. Ray is the Director of Power Supply and Operations for Missouri River Energy Services. Then we'll go to Naomi Chihura. She's the Vice President of Rates and Regulatory Strategy for Mid-American Energy. And then we'll go to Jeff Nelson, who's actually the General Manager of East River Electric Power Cooperative up in Madison. And then what we'll do is we'll take a 15-minute break after they give their initial presentations, and then that'll give you a chance to write down some questions. If you're not very familiar with what MISO is, and I hope anyone on the panel will correct me, but if you were to think of an analogy, it's kind of like a country club. You either belong or you don't. We can't force you to belong. It's up to you, whether power companies wanted to belong or they do not want to belong. If you do belong to the country club, you get to golf for free, you get to make business contacts, you get to play tennis. Everything is included in your membership. If you're not in, you have to pay every time you come into the country club. So that's where the problem comes. Now, why wouldn't you want to join MISO? Maybe you don't golf. You're very happy. Your customers are happy. So that's what we're going to be discussing today. And let me tell you, folks, we can talk about transmission, we can talk about building, we can talk about money, but this is a huge issue right here. This seam issue is probably one of the biggest hang-ups of wind in South Dakota, in my opinion. So what we need to do is we need to come to a common denominator. Hopefully we'll come to maybe some solutions. We'll talk about some problems and some solutions today. So please pay attention and get those questions ready after our 15-minute break. Like I said, how about we start with Robert Real? He's the real deal here. He's going to give a presentation from WAPA.
I guess I wasn't there yet. First of all, I want to thank everybody for coming here. We believe in these types of meetings to have a broad scope of sharing. I'm going to take an opportunity here to explain a little bit who we are. There was some discussion going over the last few days that did explain a bit of folks' perception of us. And this sharing of viewpoints, none of us are going to be entirely right, and none of us are going to be entirely wrong, and hopefully we can wend through all the correct things and try to understand the things that we perceive as being incorrect with some of the other viewpoints. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and proceed here a little bit to explain who we are. I've thrown up a picture of Western Area Power Administration, and I believe Ed Weber used this yesterday. Ed works on the transmission side, and I work on the merchant side. We are essentially functionally separated, as is required by the open access tariff requirements and standards of conduct. The portion of Western that we're going to be dealing with here is the portion that covers the state of South Dakota. It's the kind of greenish section in the upper right-hand corner. We cover the states of Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, portions of Minnesota and portions of Iowa, and the eastern portion of Nebraska. We think regionally. I guess I'm encouraged by some of the statements that are made earlier that folks should be thinking regionally as they're discussing transmission. We also encourage MISO to think regionally. That kind of comes into conflict a little bit with a discussion of how rates are designed, though, too. So. What I've thrown up here is an explanation of what we do and what our genesis is. You'll hear the name Pick Sloan thrown around. It's relative to the fact that this is a project that was developed on the Missouri River Basin, and that's essentially the states that I listed or covered earlier. We have about 2,000 megawatts of hydropower, and we serve about 300 wholesale customers in those seven states. The average generation on the Missouri River tends to be on the order of about 10,000 gigawatt hours per year. That's in a median year or a more normal year than we've been experienced for the last 7 years. We've been experiencing a drought. Our generation is down. Yet we still serve those firm contracts about 9,000 gigawatt hours a year. The difference between those two is based on a marketing plan. There's some losses included and that sort of thing. But for the most part, there's about 9,000 gigs that we have contracted for. During this drought, we've experienced everything from 90% generation down to approximately 50% generation. And that means that we're buying a significant portion. We are a cost-based entity. We're a federal entity, but we market our power on cost basis, and that those cost-based rates are about $25 a megawatt hour, beginning actually in January of 2008. We are not responsible for load growth. We're essentially marketing the resource on the river, and when we're short, we essentially buy to fill these contracts that I'm showing up on the wall here. Or if we're long, we essentially sell in the market, which is the MISO, predominantly. Let's see, did that change? Nope. Okay, here I'm showing a picture of the market, or the MISO market, and how it mates up to that picture of Western that I just showed a minute ago. You can see that we overlay in some areas, and the seam between us and the MISO is pretty much on their western boundary and our eastern boundary. So we work across that line. I work on the merchant side, so essentially we're exchanging energy across those seams. Water releases are basically defined by the Corps engineers, and they're intended to meet project purposes. They're not, electricity generation is only one of those project purposes. When we reach the stage where we are right now in the form of a drought, we're down to minimum releases essentially for stream flow and for water quality. Now, what that means is that, in essence, we probably couldn't release less water in a drought and take on wind energy. There's going to be some discussions early on. It does help, but we probably can't store water and use the wind to offset it at the stage that we're at right now. If we were in a different situation, for instance, when we're out of a drought, we're selling surpluses above and beyond what we've contracted for. We operate across the MAP MISO seam in order to do that. We also sell, of course, to the west a bit, but for the most part, it's across the MAP MISO seam. Generation has been as low as 50% in the drought. I think I mentioned that earlier. And the generation in 1996 was 150% of normal. At that point in time, we were selling considerable amount of surpluses. In last year, MISO gave written notice that it was terminating the existing seams agreement between MAP and itself, effective January 31st, 2008. That's fairly significant because it affects how we address constrained paths on that seam or outside of that seam. In June of 2007, MISO did, in working with us, discuss options to address that seams and management of the transmission line loading relief procedures. Those options. The first one was essentially a renegotiation of the existing agreement with the option of possible redispatch, which would mitigate congestion slightly different than what we're doing today. We're presently not using redispatch outside of MISO to address transmission constraints. The next one is to move essentially your generation and loads into the MISO and use the LMP markets to continue to provide transmission service under Western's OAT, but use the MISO market to address congestion. Again, the pricing signals would, in essence, come from the market model to deal with that. And the last option is to get closer to MISO, if you will. Essentially, it would be a situation where you put not only your load and generation into the MISO, but you'd also put your transmission into MISO. The only thing you would not do is sign a transmission agreement. And of course, if you looked at an option four, it would be a situation where you join MISO signing the transmission agreement. Lastly, I guess I'd kind of like to summarize what I've said here or what we're going through. Western is a MISO member. We're a non-transmission owner of MISO, member of MISO, but we, on the merchant side, are currently a member of MISO. Western's merchant, ourselves, operate across that seam, both selling, buying out of that market, and taking care of our own loads that are outside of the market. The problem with it is when the seam exists, the current method of dealing with congestion is to TLR. So the first thing is any purchases that we're making out of MISO are cut off. We have to find someone else to buy that from. And in doing that, there's so many entities that are currently inside of MISO or selling into MISO that purchasing from them is not an option anymore. We end up in an emergency situation where we call on others to essentially sell to us under emergency provisions under MAP. One thing we do know is that as we move forward, there's going to be alternatives to this seams issue, and we're intending to work through that. Most of the folks that are involved in the industry, our customers and otherwise, know that we will be going through a process to determine what choice we will make on the options offered or maybe something different. But at this point in time, that's where we're at. Thank you, Steve.
Just as a clarification point to keep everyone in the audience up to date, I just asked Robert what the MAP acronym, he's going to explain that quick.
MAP stands for Mid-Continent Area Power Pool.
Which is just a little bit different than MISO. But now, next we'll go to Ray Wall. Ray has got an extensive background in power management and generation, and Missouri River Energy Services is right here in Sioux Falls.
Thank you, Steve. And when I was asked to speak here, and we had a conference call to describe what we were supposed to do, I didn't take very good notes. And so consequently, in your packet that you got today, is you got two presentations from me. It's the second one that I'm going to go through after we had our conference call. I needed some remedial help, and Katie provided that assistance, shall we say. So in any case, the first thing I want to do is talk a little bit about nothing. Okay, just want to give you a little bit of background. Some of you may not be real familiar with who Missouri River is and what we do. We are basically a wholesale supplier of generation and transmission to municipal utilities. We are a joint action agency, and we serve 60 communities located in the four states, North and South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa. We also have some associate members. Our members serve about 250,000 customers within this region, and we are a member of MISO. We are a non-transmission owning member of MISO right now, so that means we do participate in the market. We are not a transmission owner at this time, and we are a partner in CapEx. So we are one of the investors in the CapEx facilities, as one of the earlier panels talked about. And this is going to give nothing but fits, apparently.
It's the wrong
button. Oh, it's the wrong.
The one on the right?
Yeah, push that again. Yeah, the right one is the one you want.
You get the
trigger.
Okay. See, I need a lot of remedial help, and I want to thank again Katie for that remedial help. just to give you an idea of where our membership is located, is this diagram shows you where we're at, where our members are located, and the blue dots are the members in the MISO footprint. We have about 40% of our load located within the MISO footprint and about 60% of our load located outside of the MISO footprint. Because of that, we sit right on the MISO seams agreement, or sit on the MISO seams, which creates a lot of operational issues for us when you sit on that seams to try and move power back and forth across that seam. Most of our major generation, both of our baseload and our peaking resources, are located outside of the market. So we really have no significant baseload generation or peaking generation in the market. We do have some of our wind resources. Actually, almost all of our wind resources are within the market. In terms of the wind projects that we are involved in, we have three wind projects. Our first wind project, our Worthington project, it was our first foray into wind. It was it's just 5.5 megawatts, and actually 2 megawatts of this are actually dedicated to another entity, and that was brought online, I think, in 2003. We now have under construction 2 other wind projects. Our Odin project, located near St. James, Minnesota, 20 megawatts, that should be online in January, February of next year. Our other wind project, our Marshall project, also a 20-megawatt project. We're actually going to have 2 megawatts of that online by the end of the year, with the rest coming likely in January of next year. I should also point out that all of these, Marshall and the Odin projects are seabed projects. Seabed stands for community-based energy development. They meet the seabed requirements of the Minnesota statutes. So these are our seabed projects within Minnesota. In 2008, we estimate that 8% of the energy Missouri River delivers to its members will be renewable, be coming from our wind projects, if you will. And obviously, we have no wind projects in South Dakota. The reason we don't have wind projects in South Dakota is because of some of the issues that we face should we have wind projects in South Dakota. That seems between MISO and the non-MISO area is a real challenge. And first of all, in terms of what we see as barriers to wind development, I had to list the first one up here. A lot of people have talked about that before. I'm not really going to touch on that, but I wanted to put it up here just to make sure everybody knows I didn't forget this one. These barriers to wind development in South Dakota, what we see as the barriers, are basically in order of what I would call importance to solve. So obviously the transmission, additional transmission is key in getting it solved. The second barrier that we face when we're in South Dakota, and actually this is true of almost any wind development in South Dakota, is something called pancake transmission rates. If we would develop a wind project in South Dakota, we would basically have to pay 2 or more transmission providers to get it from South Dakota into our MISO market. And so that what happens is if a utility obviously has to pay more than one transmission provider, we term that pancake transmission. And it actually becomes very expensive. The pancake transmission rates can add $10 to $15 a megawatt hour to the delivered cost of the product. And if you're in the neighborhood, if you're selling wind energy in the neighborhood of $55 to $60 is what we've seen, you know, the $10 to $15 can be a 20 to 30% cost premium on a product developed in South Dakota versus if it was just on the other side of the border within the MISO footprint. And so consequently, that's a huge competitive disadvantage for wind in South Dakota, and you probably can't make that up in a wind regime. I mean, if your wind regime is good enough, you could do it, but you probably don't have a 30% better wind regime in South Dakota versus Minnesota. And as I noted there, the majority of South Dakota sites would see a pancake transmission. The other barriers in terms of to additional wind development in South Dakota is the lack of ancillary services. Wind energy we face technical challenges to integrate wind into the system, to do it reliably, and we face challenges. And And so that technical challenge, if you will, to reliably integrate the wind into the system, you really need a large footprint to integrate that into, and then you also need what I refer to here as an ancillary service market, the ASM, if you will. And ancillary services is our terminology, so we provide that regulation, the frequency response, and the backup service that wind needs to be able to effectively and reliably integrate into a system. There are limited resources in South Dakota to do that. I think yesterday the gentleman from Western talked about that, and we would agree. I mean, there are limited resources. You need a bigger footprint to do that, and Mike from ISO also indicated that. And then finally, we think an energy market works well also. If you have an energy market, you don't have to deal with what we call physical delivery. You can deal with financial delivery, and it makes it much easier to deal with the variabilities of wind and be able to integrate the wind into your system. So these are all pieces of the puzzle that's needed in order to effectively include wind in the system. Now, since I brought up what I'd call the barriers to adding additional wind in South Dakota, I felt I needed to develop some solutions. Now, I want to point out that these solutions are going to be neither easy, they're going to be expensive, and they're not going to be without controversy. There's going to be a lot of controversy in dealing with this, but this is my my solutions, if you will, to overcome some of these barriers. First of all, of course, inadequate transmission structure, infrastructure. Obviously, a simple solution, build more transmission. A lot of speakers talked about that, and that's going to be a real challenge. It's going to be very expensive. But I'd also point out that the utilities are going to need some help in getting this accomplished. You know, with the amount of transmission that needs to be built, I think the landowners, we're going to get landowner fatigue in terms of the right-of-way. And so it's going to be a real challenge in order to build all the transmission we're talking about. So that is one of the things we do need help. We need help from the state public utility commissions to get that accomplished. Pancake transmission rates. I talked about the cost, the premium you pay for pancake transmission. So what's the solution to that? Well, the solution to that is, and Bob mentioned this, is if Western would join MISO under option 3 or become a TO, that's a transmission only member of MISO, but that does not come off without cost, and so that's why the controversy comes in. But that would solve that pancake transmission problem. And the other thing is that there's a couple gentlemen up here today that talked about RECB 1, RECB 2, Jim Wilcox of XL, Will Call of Great River talked about RECB 1 and RECB 2. Missouri River support RECB 1, RECB 2, but we don't think that's enough. We don't think that goes far enough. It was a good first step, but we definitely need to go further. And what we're really promoting is non-pancake transmission and actually go to a postage stamp rate for transmission. And it really gets at who pays for the transmission. Again, I talked about the lack of ancillary services in this region. So how do you get more ancillary services? Well, first of all, MISO is going to create an ancillary service market, but in order for that, for South Dakota to take advantage of that, everybody in South Dakota has to be in the ancillary service market. And so you could accomplish that if the utilities in South Dakota would join MISO actually under option 2, option 3, or to become a MISO TO. I would also point out, in order to have ancillary services, really, to meet the technical requirements of wind, the more wind you install, you really got to install more thermal generation. I mean, that's what really boils down. This is where you get your ancillary services from. So we're going to need to support the addition, not only of transmission, but additional thermal generation to meet those ancillary service requirements. And then finally, in terms of we need an energy market in South Dakota, and to accomplish that, again, utilities in South Dakota should join either MISO under option 2, 3, or become a MISO TO. I would point out that Missouri River is already in MISO as a non-transmission-owning member of MISO, and we are planning to join MISO. We're actually in the application process right now to join MISO as a TO. And thank you.
I'm actually glad, Ray, that you went ahead of me so that you could solve the technical difficulties before I would start to have them. So, I'm Naomi Chahura. I'm Vice President of Rates and Regulatory Strategy for Mid-American Energy. And I'm going to bring a little bit different perspective, I think, to this probably than any of the other folks that have so far. I will freely admit I have no engineering background whatsoever. Don't understand many of the logistics of transmission, and wouldn't know how to design wind power if I needed to save my life. What I've primarily looked at in my career is looking at business opportunities, trying to evaluate those opportunities, and also looking at how to recover costs of assets once those assets have actually been put in the ground, or maybe even before the assets have been put in the ground. And it's a different perspective, but I think it's a perspective that's relevant to this issue of how to get wind built in South Dakota. First of all, I'd like to give you a little introduction to MidAmerican. MidAmerican Energy Company operates in South Dakota, only a little bit on electric, more on the gas side. It's primarily based in Iowa. Our headquarters is in Des Moines. We have a little service territory in Illinois and also some in Nebraska. We are, however, part of a bigger organization, MidAmerican Energy Holdings Company, which is owned by Berkshire Hathaway, which you may be a little familiar with through Warren Buffett. Other MEHC companies include PacifiCorp, which is a West Coast utility, CE Electric in the UK, which has distribution, electric and gas distribution there, Cal Energy Generation, which has geothermal generation, which I also know very little about the engineering of, Kern River Gas Transmission Company, and Northern Natural Gas, which are gas pipelines. MEHC is also notably in a partnership with AEP pursuing transmission ventures in Texas and elsewhere in the country. And I have been involved in that to some degree. MidAmerican Energy Company, which is the company that I work for, does have some experience with wind power. We started getting into this earlier in the decade, a little reluctantly at first, perhaps, but nevertheless got there. Right now, we are the largest utility owner and operator of wind with 460 megawatts currently operational, and another 213 planned by the end of the year. By 2009, we anticipate that about 12% of our total energy and about 18% of our nameplate capacity will come from wind energy. And that's without an RPS. Uh-oh. I'll never figure out how to go back, right? Okay. I won't go through all these, but since this is in your packet there, that's just a highlight of the wind projects that we have currently up and running, a history of what's there and when it came online. And I will say, Iowa Wind, I think, in our viewpoint, has been a success story, and I think for some reasons that maybe are pertinent to South Dakota as well, although they may be a little harder to solve in South Dakota. Iowa is 10th in the nation in wind resources, but right now is 3rd in the nation in actual resources online. And the reason for that is really because we had a legislature and a regulatory regime and a governor who were very committed to making that happen. They were willing to change some legislation to allow utilities to own and operate wind resources. Our governor, Tom Vilsack, at the time challenged us to meet some targets, and I was thinking about that as I was looking at the presentation, and I thought, they're going to want to know what those targets were, and I thought, I don't really know anymore. I've forgotten. And that's kind of relevant because once we got started, the targets really weren't important anymore because we had an enthusiasm for wind. We found we could do it. We found we could integrate it. We liked the way it operated. And so we've basically gone ahead and kept adding wind and have totally forgotten about the targets. We're going to easily meet them, and so they're not really relevant anymore. But they certainly were relevant at the beginning. The other thing that occurred was there was some legislation passed that allowed for some advanced rate-making principles. And this is a little bit relevant perhaps to the proposal that was mentioned earlier about interim cost recovery. This didn't give us interim cost recovery, but what it did was to give us some certainty about the cost recovery related to these assets. That they were, you know, we knew what kind of a return we were going to get. We knew how many dollars we could spend on them and not have to worry about cost disallowances. We knew what kind of depreciation life we were going to be including for them. So a lot of what we perceived as regulatory risk was kind of taken away in this process. And just to give you a little background as to why that was so important, we were among the utilities who built a lot of generation in the 1980s. And when the load growth that we anticipated didn't materialize, we ended up being penalized for having built those assets. So that's one of the reasons for our shareholders anyway, that this was an important piece. And I think it's an important piece to any of this. It was mentioned yesterday that the utility business is a very capital-intensive business. You're talking about a lot of dollars of investment, and anything that you can do to make that investment less risky really helps. And so this was of extreme importance to us. I'll skip through some of the other stuff a little bit more because it's really relevant to utility wind, which maybe isn't so relevant here. Once you kind of get rid of the financial risk a little bit, the adequacy of the wind resource and whether it's going to be there when you need it and at the level that you thought it would be is kind of a risk, is a pretty significant risk. It's been mentioned also that site diversification helps with that. It also helps with your ability to dispatch the wind and deal with the swings it causes. And you've seen other graphs. This just, for us, this is our experience, and it bears out that wind is kind of variable and that it's not really there during the peak. I guess that's something else that was mentioned yesterday that I will stress. It's not a capacity resource to any great degree. You can get some capacity out of it, but largely, at least in the Midwest, at the time when you'd really like to have it from a capacity standpoint, it's just not there. Doesn't mean it has no value, but it is a problem, and it has caused it to be seen as less valuable in the past. The other thing that's kind of interesting about wind power that's different for utilities are, we're used to dealing with landowners related to transmission lines, which has been an issue here. The landowner relationship for wind power is a little bit different. Utilities traditionally built transmission lines, and you'd go in and basically get your easement and you build your line and then you're done and you don't see the landowner again. When you're looking at putting up a wind turbine, you're talking about something that you're going to have to operate and maintain over a 20 plus year period, and it's going to be on that landowner's property. So you really have a little bit different dynamic. You need to be in a position where that landowner's happy with you and is happy with the fact that you're putting the wind turbine on his property. And there may be some lessons there to be learned for transmission. I don't know. Something we might want to think about a little bit. Looking at the sources of wind project income, retail sales revenue is, of course, important for a utility. I guess if you're not a utility, you don't quite have retail sales revenue in the same way. The federal production tax credit's been mentioned. That is, I would echo that that's extremely important still, and the fact that that has not been consistently applied has been kind of a problem for the industry. A longer-term approval of a PTC would be very beneficial. Sale of renewable energy credits is also a source of income, and if we can get some markets going in that, that would be helpful. Also increased wholesale energy sales and capacity credits, although that's limited. Just give you a quick snapshot of wind development and where it stands right now. There are still challenges. I mean, you hear about wind proceeding quickly. Transmission's not the only challenge. The prices have gone up for wind turbines. Since we started building them, they've more than doubled. And our concern is renewable portfolio standards could cause that to go higher yet. Turbine availability is an issue, primarily because of the lack of a long-term production tax credit and unwillingness, because of that, of suppliers to build in this country significant facilities, although that's changing a little bit. Payments to landowners have increased as landowners have become more sophisticated and have more realization of the value that they can get out of this. And as mentioned, transmission is still a problem, as is the variability of wind production can still be a limiting factor. Mid-American, quite honestly, will probably focus more on its development of wind in Iowa. Iowa is within our own footprint. There is substantial wind resources there as well. It's, from our standpoint, it's easier from a siting standpoint and from transmission availability and cost. Not that we wouldn't consider adding wind resources from somewhere else, but right now that's probably, honestly, where our focus will be. In order to consider probably additional wind beyond what's in Iowa, we would have to be looking at some kind of additional gas-fired generation, probably, to allow for some kind of backup for that wind. We would be looking at maybe adding some kind of storage capability or also perhaps some type of intermittent load. I know plug-in hybrids has been mentioned as something that might be workable, and we will be keeping an eye on those. As far as what's needed for South Dakota, basically, I think it's been said all throughout the last couple of days, you need to enable siting of transmission. Regional cooperation, I think, is essential. You have a national interest corridor designation available, but our belief is that that's not really a very workable way to get things done. You still need to allow the states to have an opportunity to look at transmission before the federal government can provide the backstop authority. And it's an extremely time-consuming process, and I think you'll end up with some states that aren't very happy. So our viewpoint is that regional cooperation is probably the best way to go at that. And our sister company, PacifiCorp, is involved in an effort like that out west, if any of you are interested. It's called the Northern Tier Transmission Group, and it has participation from both buyers and sellers. I think offhand, the states that are involved in that are Montana, Idaho, Oregon, Utah, and Wyoming. So it's got both folks on the consuming end and on the production end. They do have a website that's out there if anybody is interested in looking at what they're doing. It's www.nttg.biz, B-I-Z, and that could provide a model for a way forward. The other thing that's extremely important is assurance of cost recovery. You have to determine who pays, and that's a regional issue as well. The other thing is the ability to finance wind development. And that basically, you can do that through a utility build option, as we've done in Iowa. Also, otherwise, you can do it through long-term contracts. But that's been an issue in some states that have open access, that you need a long-term contract to support wind generation. And if you can't, if you're doing something like an auction, something like that, it doesn't work very well. So that's all I had, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you.
All right, next is Jeff Nelson, then we'll take a break. So be sure, if you have a question, be writing it down. We'll take a quick 15-minute break after Jeff is done, and we'll come back.
Thank you, Steve. I wish to offer my thanks to the organizers of this forum. Great to see a broad profile of folks, particularly the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission members of our legislature that are showing interest and support for this initiative. I'd like to spend a few minutes addressing a few issues from a perspective of a organization that is perhaps a little different, brings a little different view to the development of these resources. East River Electric is part of a regional power supply network of cooperatives that I'd like to talk about in profile, describe what we have done in actually building wind and enabling wind to be developed in both the MISO footprint as well as within the transmission control area, the network that the cooperatives have historically, along with the other not-for-profit utilities in this region, helped build in the integrated system that Bob Real talked about. And then finish with some views on an outlook. Just very briefly, this is the area that is the East River Power System. We are a collection of small utilities. We are part of a network of not-for-profit cooperatives that number about 1,000 in the United States, serve about 7% of the total population, but have the unique challenge to serve areas that others historically have not been willing to serve, about 90% of the geography of this country. Within our footprint, the cooperatives that provide the retail service and receive wholesale power from East River, on the average, have about 2.5 customers per mile of line. In some parts of our service area in the north central part of the state, this is an area where you have to have your own Tomcat. There are less than one customer per mile of line in some of those systems. So it's a real challenge to serve those areas. And the legacy of the cooperatives is that our business model was developed for the purpose of providing service that could be both affordable and reliable to bring Central Station service into those rural areas. We think we've done a fairly good job of that. We realized early on that if we were going to be successful as co-ops, we had to aggregate. Aggregation is kind of a new idea that's had some attention in policy with retail choice and those kinds of things, and folks that recognize that in order to succeed in the market, you have to aggregate. Well, the cooperatives, I've often said, are the original aggregators. East River is a result of a federation of 21 underlying retail cooperatives that needed to have more strength in order to secure transmission and access to generating resources. As East River, those folks that came before me at East River looked at that question, they realized that it needed to be taken to the next level. And the next level was to aggregate then customers over a much broader region, and rather than individually constructing relatively small generating resources, bring together the needs of cooperatives across a very large region and organize a regional cooperative power supply system. It was premised on a pretty simple vision, and that is that we can do better from an economic standpoint for the customers that we serve and to provide reliable service by building a network that looks to partnership as an underlying purpose, that uses a transmission system to move energy rather than relying on the railroads who have not treated Middle America kindly and are certainly demonstrating that today. So the vision was to take advantage of size by aggregation, rely on transmission to move energy rather than rail, and locate thermal units on mine-mouth opportunities. Part of the ability to do that was a partnership that has developed also with the federal government through the rural electrification that's made possible central station service in areas that otherwise wouldn't be served, but also partnerships that historically developed around the ability of not-for-profit utilities to have access to the federal hydro systems. As those nonprofit entities subscribed to that system at the time, as ridiculous as it sounds today, actually that hydro system was a above-market resource. But the cooperative interests in this region followed also with the not-for-profit municipal interests along with federal and state entities subscribed to that system, made it possible, helped launch what unfortunately someone described to me in the hall yesterday as what is now viewed as a byproduct of that network, and that is hydropower that is very, very tightly defined against other competing priorities for the use of that water. Today, the network of cooperatives in this region that are outside of MISO primarily then have relied on that foundational resource of the hydro system and supplemented that with what is today about 2,700 megawatts of wind, coal, and gas. The other piece of the sensitivity that we have to the development of these kinds of new resources has to do with the importance that the bulk transmission network in this region offers for reliability and cost-effective delivery. Dale Osborne talked about a reality that we've always faced in this region, is that we've got an enormous amount of geography and not very much load. And he made the observation that those two realities are oxymorons. You can't make those two fit. The cooperatives realized that in the early 60s and said we need to cooperate once again in developing a shared network of a transmission resource that initially and for the better part of 30 years was operated under open access principles as a joint transmission network that served all of the utility interests in the region, but was essentially and remains as a foundational part of our ability to serve customers in this region. Open access has now changed that, the development of the Midwest ISO that are using, in the view of some of us, their market position in transmission to force changes that some of us believe may not necessarily serve well underlying customers, creates some of these discussions about the institutional paralysis that has developed as a result of the uncertainties of who develops, who pays, notices that force renegotiation of SEAMS agreements and then generate all of the questions about who the winners and losers are in that proposition. This integrated system, while it's operated very effectively by the Western Area Power Administration, has a large stake in what has been a 40-year and a continuing investment by nonprofit utilities in the region. I put this on the screen to talk about this federal system, which is really a jointly owned system. It was a precedent-making idea in the 1960s that you could put together this kind of an arrangement. It's worked well. Our hope is that it can continue to work well and not be the purposes that it serves not considered as part of developing new SEAMS agreements and other public policy. This is just a quick look at the East River Transmission Network, which is really some would describe as a sub-transmission system, but it's a federated network that we actually operate on both sides of the seams. About probably 90% of the load that East River serves to our members is out of the MISO footprint and the balance in the MISO footprint. Our business model doesn't really compel us to be very interested in venture plays, to be participants in investments that will leverage opportunities that are founded on the prospect of converting the value, whether it's of wind or other resources, into returns for investors, because our business model is not for profit. We exist because others won't serve these areas, so we look at our customers as the investors that rely on us to deliver reliability and affordable energy, and that's the return in the social compact of having power supply in rural areas. Having said that, the cooperatives have really led the way in this region, in our opinion, in the development of renewables. Today we've got 136 megawatts that have been developed in the power supply network, a substantial portion of that within East River service area. The first commercial wind that we turned up was way back in 2001, and in the development of wind in this area, that's now ancient history. The last units that we brought online were in January of last year, and all of the electrons that are being generated along with the green attributes are done for the benefit of our customers. So we have used effectively the transmission resources that have been developed to now begin a more aggressive integration of renewable resources. It's not only wind that we're focused on. We're pursuing what are some pretty fascinating and, once again, precedent-making developments. We are aligning ourselves with a Israeli company that has developed a technique to convert what is the waste heat that is being exhausted at many of the compressor stations in the Northern Border Pipeline that passed through this area. And that hot air has been is being exhausted into the atmosphere. We've come together and have put in place what are today four heat recapture units. Three of those reside on East River's transmission system that are capturing and reusing that that waste heat. We've got a couple more in the pipeline. We've also worked hard to be welcoming to other kinds of renewables. Joel Dykstra, who has contributed mightily in the state to the development of dairy, helped lead also a focus on the opportunity to capture methane from manure in those sites. We've got the only in the first anaerobic digester that is actually being used to also produce electricity that is being purchased by the cooperatives. So we're pretty proud of that for sure. I guess the other part of our bona fides with respect to this whole topic is that we expect within the next 36 months to commit to what will be another 300 megawatts of wind development in the Dakotas, and the addition of at least another 14 megawatts of compression waste heat, which will lead the cooperatives in this region to have as part of our resource base just a shade less than 500 megawatts of generation. Now, we are obviously hopeful that the transmission network will continue to permit us to do that. We've recognized that we have to be a player in this because we have tasked ourselves internally to achieve 10% of our resources voluntarily from renewables by the year 2010. I think actually we're going to beat that. We'll probably exceed it. And I want to talk a little bit more about what we intend to do legislatively to identify that as a priority for us. We also recognize, though, that we need to be welcoming to these kind of resources as transmission owners in the region. We've done that. We've developed what have been successful ability to provide station service, access. We have standing purchase power offers for the development of small wind. We've developed those policies and procedures and worked within and without MISO to enable those kind of developments. We've also loaned our system. Our telecommunications network in the region has lots of towers. So we partnered 5 or 6 years ago with the Public Utilities Commission in South Dakota, as well as South Dakota State University, to put up what is today known as the Wind Resource Anemometer Network, RAN, that is continuing to broaden the profile of data for the development of wind. Katie just said I've got 2 minutes left, and that was about 30 seconds ago. So I'm going to end my remarks by offering some perspectives on several areas. I've identified here fair rules and processes, reasonable incentives, and who pays. Let me just touch on some perspectives that as cooperatives we would bring to the table. First of all, there's a lot of frustration on the part of our customers as to why the co-ops aren't owning more wind, developing more wind. Well, just like Bob Goff talked about yesterday, the tribes are outside of the economic circle of the tax benefits that are available to and targeted to large for-profit entities. Cooperatives as not-for-profit entities don't incur a tax liability, so we must deal with third parties for the development of wind. It also has limited the ability to pursue local investment, and that is a serious frustration in South Dakota among landowners that believe there should be more to the value proposition for them than simply having to negotiate wind rights and perhaps be in a better position as the 15,000 corn farmers are, about 10,000 of those who are now invested in ethanol, that take that second bite of the value-added apple. If there is this value in wind and there is a merchant opportunity to move it out of this state, we believe that policymakers need to help redefine that value proposition to include landowners, or when it comes time to define corridors, to talk about quick take and some of those things, that it will not be successful because landowners are going to be hesitant at best to grant transmission access with what, for those of us that work in this industry, think are absolutely beautiful pieces of construction. That is not a universally held point of view. We are continuing to deal with conflicting public policy. We're troubled by, and frankly, as the cooperatives are looking at the 100 megawatt developments that are at least a year or so down the road, we are now confronted with public policy being advanced by the Fish and Wildlife Service that has suggested that maybe there's a 200-mile-wide corridor from Alberta, Canada to Texas, 100 miles on either side of the Missouri River that would become exclusion areas because of concerns of the whooping crane. I mean, they're doing their job. That's what the law is with relation to endangered species. But it is putting in jeopardy questions about whether or not wind can be developed in central South Dakota. Let me touch just briefly on the system operators piece. In some ways, I think we have created institutional barriers that are limiting the ability for utilities to make the right decisions about operations. We've constructed very complicated markets, and indeed markets can serve some purposes. But it's not markets that have made possible reliable service in rural areas of South Dakota. We are not market-driven folks, and we intend to continue to bring that perspective into these discussions. Questions of transporting values of the Missouri River hydro system to serve ancillary market purposes and convert those kinds of services into market-based features trouble us because, frankly, what it does is move the public resources to serve purposes that we don't believe are the appropriate purpose to serve. Reasonable incentives, let me turn to that. The co-ops this year are going to offer, ask the South Dakota legislature to pursue two initiatives. The first is to adopt in South Dakota a renewable energy objective. Secondly, we think that maybe it's time to begin thinking about focusing incentives on the development of the delivery part of the wind equation. We've clearly demonstrated that the production incentives for that side of the equation are working. The transmission side isn't. So we're going to offer some thinking with a fairly modest but nonetheless, I think, new idea on how we should begin to, in South Dakota, focus some incentives on the development of the delivery resources and not necessarily on the generating side of it. Let me just finish the who pays part of this by saying that This is an issue that is very significant. You've heard discussion about how do we solve this MISO problem and the imposition of MISO standards that don't fit very well in a transmission network that was built for a much different purpose that serves a much different underlying customer base. Now, not entirely, but certainly an important part of it. We believe a significant issue that has to be resolved, that won't accomplish any solutions on seams, is until MISO is willing to entertain average pricing for the pooling of these networks. If they don't do that, we're going to continue to do hedgerow-to-hedgerow fights over seams. MISO will continue to use its strength in the market, I think, to, in some people's view, accomplish good public policy in the view of some of us to disadvantage nonprofit utilities that have an important role in this region. So we got to do average pricing. I think that was 2 minutes. I'm not sure, Katie, but if it wasn't, accept my apology.